Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive, but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical. Hey, everybody, this is Pascal. I am back with another episode of Disrupt Disruption, this time with a dear friend and an old colleague of mine, David Bray. David is a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council and the Stimson Center. He's also the principal at Lead Do Adapt Ventures. We'll get, I am sure, into what that is and what you're doing there. Very briefly, David has an incredible background. He has served in a variety of leadership roles in turbulent environments. I literally have seen pictures of David with bulletproof vests in war-torn areas, including bioterrorism preparedness and response from 2000 to 2005, time on the ground in Afghanistan in 2009, serving as the nonpartisan executive director for a bipartisan national committee on R&D, and providing leadership as a nonpartisan federal agency senior executive. So David has done kind of it all. And I'm really curious because, David, you bring a very different perspective to innovation and disruption. So welcome.
Well, thank you, Pascal. It's great to be here. And now you said, with that humbling introduction, I've got to rise to the challenge and hopefully bring to you the disruption to your podcast.
I am sure we'll get there. Talking about which, my typically starting question, I'm really curious about, how do you even think and define disruption for you in your world, for your conceptual model?
So when you shared my background a bit, I seem to be one of those people that is pulled to change adverse environments, which is typically what some people would call either government or bureaucracy. But also I've worked in, you know, nonprofits are great, but they also seem to have sometimes their interesting processes as well. And that's because in some respects, they are some of the key cornerstones of civil society. And I'm watching the world around us, what's happening with technology and data, and civil societies are being challenged to keep up with the pace of change. And what I worry is if we're not careful, things will just get so dramatic in the changes that will empower autocracies, which would be a form of disruption, where we see autocracies take control because people want certainty, they want things in black and white, they don't like these shades of gray. But personally, I'm not a big fan of autocracies because I believe that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Or we just throw out any type of social order, that it's just laissez-faire and maybe it's just everyone for themselves. And that may sound great until everyone starts shooting at each other or things like that, and it becomes anarchy. And so I go into organizations knowing they have challenges, they have faults, they're going to resist disruption, but that they need to figure out some form of positive disruption, if only to jump to where the world is, to stay relevant, and ideally provide stability for the world we're in.
Let me stay there for a second, because you just used the word positive disruption, which I really like. It's an interesting comment. And on this podcast, we had a couple of our guests already pointing out that they don't actually like the word disruption because it implies destruction, negativity in the world you described as the civil society, the uprising, which is clearly destructive. Mm-hmm. It is disruptive, but it's also destructive. I'm curious, how do you establish positive disruption? How do you approach this in a setting of like a nonprofit or a for-profit organization?
Great question. And I think the first step is you always have to be mindful of the actions you're doing, because you are perturbing the system. And if you are a disruptor, and I think you should own that you are a disruptor, you just hope you're a positive one and not the alternative, you are perturbing the system and you have to be mindful of your actions because it is going to involve some form of destruction. I think the best thing a leader can do is help organizations, help communities let go of the old with grace. But it is about letting go of the old, either the old way of doing it, the old set of beliefs. Still in society, we still have some historical beliefs we need to let go of. The reality is all humans are created equal, but we still have parts of society that don't realize that yet. We still have legacy pay scales that need to be actually addressed and things like that. I raise that because if you are a positive disruptor, you still need to own the fact that you are about letting go of things that were historical or things that need to be let go of the organization, but do so with dignity and grace. That includes recognizing those people that might not initially be along for the ride. They may be the laggards. I don't focus on the people that are never going to come along. That's about 15% of the organization. But I do try to address solidly the middle, because if you only surround yourself with the early adopters, you'll start to drink your own Kool-Aid and you're going to think all you're doing is great and everything is wonderful. And you'll miss the middle, and that middle will come along and they will consume you. So if you really want to be a positive disruptor, you've got to actually, quite frankly, listen to and surround yourself with people that are disagreeing with you, because that will be the only way that you are constantly going through a mental checklist of how do I know for sure what I'm doing really is positive disruption, and the destruction that I am putting in place, the letting go of the legacy, really is for the best for the community or organization.
How do you get the middle to follow? Clearly, we see it in civil society at the moment, but I would also argue you see it a lot in organizations, in commercial entities, where, yes, there is the early adopters and they're all for innovation, disruption, the new thing. The middle, at least my experience is, very often tends to resist this pretty violently, as in, please don't change anything. Also driven by fear, clearly, what does this mean for me? What does it mean for my place of work, my paycheck, etc.? What have you seen works in terms of how do you get them to rally behind the necessity for change?
Absolutely. It goes back to human nature. People aren't prone to change when they feel things are good enough. And there's two techniques that I use. First is, it's not so much about following, it's about how do you convert people from being problem holders or problem admirers to problem solvers. And oftentimes there are things in an organization, for-profit or nonprofit or government, that people know aren't working. But they want to admire it, or they want to, in some respects, it's a bonding activity to complain about it. So that's where you, as a agent of change, have to go in there and say, so how do people think things are going? What they think is working, what they think is not working. And then when that brave soul speaks up and says, and I actually had this happen, I went into an organization and within 2 weeks, this was at the Federal Communications Commission, within 2 weeks, I did an all hands. Some of it was in person, some of it was virtual. And I asked, how were things going? Only 15% of people were excited. That was partly because there had been about 9 people in 8 years in the role that I was inheriting prior to me, which I'd say is just a great sign that things are just going great when you have that amount of turnover. And half of the people owned to the fact, they said, we're just honest, we're just wondering whether or not you're still going to be here in 6 months. And the good news is I was there for 4 years, so I definitely was well past the standard deviation. But at the very end, someone raised their hand and said, I have a beef. And I was intentionally only asking questions. That's the other thing I say, is always seek to understand before you seek to be understood. Mm-hmm. And I said, could you please tell me more? And he said, it happened 17 years ago. And again, I just showed up 2 weeks ago, but he said, it happened 17 years ago. And he told me what it was. And at the end, I said, I appreciate you sharing that. So how do you think we should solve it? How can we carry that lesson forward for what we're doing? It was the idea of honoring the grief, honoring the scar, and then going from that scar and saying, okay, but then what are we going to do about it going forward? And you're not going to get everybody. And initially, people are going to be still dubious. Is this just a trick or something like this? Is when things really come to shove, is this really just going to be his way or the highway? But if you find those people that are willing to become problem solvers, and it's not just the early adopters, it really is the people that are in the trenches that I would actually say, whenever you go into an organization, the people that rush to you first to rally around you are usually the problem themselves. It's the people that are so busy, you have to seek them out because they're actually getting stuff done. I would just raise and say, shift into being problem solvers, foster them up. And then when stuff hits the fan, that's really when the organization is going to be looking at you, because they're going to see when things hit the fan, do you blame people? Do you start pointing fingers? Or do you just say, okay, so what are we going to do about it? And then you take the hit, you get the spears thrown your way, but you say, look, what are we going to do about it? And I think if you can model just that the world needs more problem solvers and it's a team sport as opposed to just you, that's how you get the middle to come along.
That's interesting. It's like, it reminds me to, I think my very first boss kept telling me, never let a good crisis go to waste. Very similar. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think a very similar approach here. If we rewind a little bit, we already jumped into how do you actually get the middle to be activated and to follow and to lead ultimately. If we rewind this and get to the start of the engagement, essentially like you're coming into an organization, I'm curious, when you're thinking about innovation, disruption, you want to change something, there needs to be something to be changed. How do you approach this from the start? What is the first couple of things you found work to get an organization, which tends to be a huge body of mass, which moves typically relatively slowly, to actually move?
Yes. Well, I look at my job as almost being like a detective, or I came from public health and bioterrorism preparedness. And so it's almost like an epidemiologist, which is who's getting sick? Why are they getting sick? How long are they sick? It's where are the things that are not working in the organization or working in what we're providing as a service or whatever it might be, for-profit or nonprofit. So you spend that time listening to different theories and you're going to hear different versions. And everyone's got their story and it's all manifestations of something. But oftentimes nobody, if they're in the middle of it, they cannot see the real thick of the problem. In fact, I say the most valuable thing any agent of positive change can do is make visible the invisible in the organization. And that's really what you're trying to do. You're trying to figure out, is this a story of classic how epidemiology was born? People were getting sick with cholera. They didn't know why. And then it took Jon Snow mapping out where they were getting sick and eventually saying, oh, it's coming from this place. And the legend goes, he turned off the pipe and that was it. It's not that easy usually when things are dysfunctional in an organization, but you really are trying to build a theory of the case. And you're trying to use that very short window of that honeymoon period you have to be looking from the balcony down on the dance floor as opposed to being stuck on the dance floor. And then once you have that, then you float it and see how people respond. And you'll know you're onto something when you start getting a violent reaction from some pockets, because you've now discovered the thing that they didn't want revealed. And again, it's subconscious. I don't think it's like they're like trying to hide it consciously. It's just, you know, now you've hit a nerve. It's not just the superficial stuff. And you have to figure out then what's your campaign to create positive disruption. And I often think you first have to do some small wins, because you're trying to get, one, you're trying to test the model, the muscles of your organization. They may have been atrophied or they may not have even been used at all. And once you get the small wins, then you go for the big bet, sort of like what you said, never waste a crisis. I'm a big believer of burn the bridges approach. So again, in a past life, I was in a place that had more than 207 systems, average age more than 10 years old. The average government person had been there for 18 years. The average contractor had been there for 21 years. So the contractors were there longer than the government people. And here I am showing up, and they know that if I modernize and I make things more efficient, I'm going to actually cut some of the contracts, which means I'm going to cut relationships that may have been on average for 10 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. So of course they're going to resist me. They're not going to come out and say it, but they're going to resist me. I had to burn the bridges, which was, we're going to go to public cloud. I could sell that in terms of it was part of modernization, but the real reason was that would give me an inventory of what we had, because oftentimes when you think you know your infrastructure, you don't. And two, I also discovered along the way that because the workload was so high, some of our security people, both government and contractor, were signing off on things that had not been fully assessed, which of course is every CIO's worst nightmare, that you think you have everything solved when in fact you don't, and you don't know where you've got the vulnerabilities. So it's the idea of first theory of case, first step. Second, do some small wins, and then figure out that big intervention that they can't come back from to move them forward.
Talking about that big intervention, the burning the bridges, presumably it requires a lot of leadership strength or willingness to ultimately also fail on your end. This could backfire really badly, and it could have been the end of your career, at least in this particular part of the organization or the organization at large. How much do you think is the relevancy of a leader who's willing to essentially do what the leader thinks is right to do, despite their own career ambitions?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. You hear people that say, how many of us have ever been in an organization that says, I want you to be innovative, but don't disrupt anything or do anything risky? And it's like, well, wait, no, you can't do innovation with, you know, real innovation without having some risk to it. Or they want you to lead, but they're saying you're taking too much risk. And it's like, well, that's not leadership then. That's just management. If we're meeting expectations or if we're managing risk, that's all about management. I'll give another example, and this is not even from my example. They're getting ready to launch another one of the space telescopes, and it's never been done before. It's going to be the James Webb telescope. And one of the principal scientists on the project said, you know, they asked, are you worried or not? And he said, we have a plan. We've gone through it, and now it's about execution. And sure, the dice may be rolled and some fluke may happen or something like that, but we trust in the plan. And when you're a leader, you don't worry about covering your butt, and you don't worry about the fact that there will be things that go bump in the night, because that will happen. But what you need to trust in is, one, did you have a good plan? And two, did you try to assign the best people you could around it? And then you just back them. I often say my job is to be a human flak jacket. And yes, and actually for one of these things, when we were doing the modernization effort, we got there. And believe it or not, we found this one small bug that tied us up for 2 days. You never would have thought it. Without going into too much detail for listeners, there are some extra special firewall capabilities that need to be done within government. And we were seeing some people could log in and some people couldn't. And we were trying to figure out why. And it turned out that the firewall, which we didn't own, it was actually owned by a different government agency that was providing a service for us, was truncating if there was a certain amount of bytes in the initial conversation between the servers. So if your password was a certain length, you would get in. If your password was beyond a certain length, you would not get in. And it's just that small little bug that tied us up for 2 days. But that's where I kept on going. I got called up to top leadership. They're like, what's going on? When are things going to come back? I'm like, we will get through this. We will make it work. And then, you know, I showed calmness to them. And when I'm back to the team, I said, okay, what are we trying next? What are we going to try next? We will figure this out. And it turned out on Friday at 4:30 p.m., just when we were about to probably hit the deadline of do we revert back or not, they figured it out and they moved forward. And there's some grumbling for about 2 weeks, but then we got it to a better place. And the result was, by taking that risk, instead of spending 85% of our budget to maintain systems more than 207 years old, it was now less than 35%. So, you know, it was worth it. But that's where, as a leader, you've got to trust in your people and trust in the plan and take the flak as it comes your way.
How much does this then also require to have top leadership, like your boss and their boss's bosses, to be backing you? You know, otherwise you're on an open field. But how much do you, as an innovation leader going into an organization, are you actually looking for that? How much do you screen that before you take the job?
So oftentimes you can't know until you're in the inside. Everyone will do the happy conversation when they're interviewing. Of course, we're going to support you. Or of course, we're going to support you. And you get on the inside and you realize, no, there's these dynamics. And in fact, in my case, because I often work in a government setting, you get a different boss every 2 or 3 years anyway. So you don't even get to pick your boss. And I've worked in settings where they are bipartisan in nature. And so you have bosses from both parties, which means at any given moment, there may be one party that just wants to make hay to throw mud at the other party. I don't think you can go in with that in mind. But you do need to be wise of the power dynamics that are around you and above you. I'm not one of those people that I tell truth to power. Sometimes power listens and sometimes power says, you're crazy, you made this up. And it's like, no, here's the data. But you're like, you still made it up. But that's okay. And I did a report with the former chair of the National Intelligence Council and some other authors. We did it in 2017, 2018, where we were looking at the last 25 years. And we found an interesting pattern that regardless of political administration in the United States, political leaders were getting more and more political in terms of the amount of political appointees they were naming. So even the job I had, which was nonpartisan at the time nowadays, is probably a political appointee now. So they're doing more and more roles that used to be nonpartisan senior executives in government are political appointees. And our theory of the case, because this was on both sides of the aisle, is as the world gets more turbulent and it's changing more, they want to have their close friends around them because they feel like they can trust them simply because of their tribal affiliation. But oftentimes, these are people that don't know the lay of the land, that are not willing to speak truth to power. In fact, I'm seeing on both sides of the political aisle a disturbing trend, which is, I'm not going to tell you what you need to hear. I'm going to tell you what I think you want to hear because I want to maintain my relationship with you. And that's usually a recipe. Look at what happened with the Challenger explosion with the space shuttle. When you play to what people want to hear versus what they need to hear, people can get killed or worse. And I'm willing to fall on that sword. I don't know how many other people are. And the other exacerbating factor that we also did on this report, which came out in 2019 and in early 2019, we said within a year, a crisis will happen where the federal government will lack the ability to respond to it. We don't know what it is. It might be cybersecurity. It might be a pandemic and crap. Whoops, we were wrong. Or, well, anyway, you know, I raise that because it's just simply we've eroded the ability to have representatives that will speak truth to power because we've made things political on both sides of the aisle. I just raise that because as a leader, you have to decide what is more important. Yeah. Is it when you look in the mirror 10 years from now, 15 years from now, did you say the right thing even if they didn't listen to it, even if they threw mud your way? Or did you say what they needed to, or what they wanted to hear, unfortunately, what they wanted to hear versus what they needed to hear, and maybe things went bad a year later or 2 years?
Let me talk about disruption for a second. You bring a very unique perspective to this conversation, particularly in the greater context of the disruption work we are doing. It's typically more on the business side. I love your much broader civil society infused view. When you think about disruption, is disruption something you typically drive or is it something you react to?
I definitely think you should not be reacting. If all you're doing is reacting to disruption, that's a recipe for failure. You will be shaped by other forces. So you have to have a plan to be positively disruptive in the space you operate. Otherwise, you've given control and you've given up, you know, any autonomy to your destiny. My wife joking, she says, you seem to pick the places that are always on fire. And then you're surprised when you sometimes get burnt. I'm like, yes, but the reason why I want to go to them is they're on fire because at least it's very clear what they need to do, that the status quo is not good enough. The worst place to be, in my opinion, is being an organization that's not doing great, but it's not doing bad. And if you go there, then you're just watching the gradual decline before people finally realize we got to do something.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Are there any red flags? We talked a lot about the factors you see which need to be done and really lead to helping organizations to move through this transition. Are there any yin to the yang, any red flags you see when you look at an organization, you're like, man, this is going to go horribly wrong. I can tell you right now.
Yes. If you see clicks, that is a recipe for death, especially when you've got an organization, maybe it feels like it needs to change, and maybe a few top leaders have bought into it, and their solution has been, let's bring in some outsiders and have them separate from the existing people on the team. That is a recipe for death at that point in time, because now you're going to create turf warfare. The existing people are going to be like, well, why weren't we listened to? The new people are going to bring in these ideas, but then they're not going to feel like they're getting any adoption by the existing people. You've really got to say it's a team sport, and we've all got to do it. Also, if they create a single office to do it. If they create a single office to do it, it's like, okay, great. Now you absolved anyone else. They created Office of Innovation. I'm like, oh crap. You know, that is death. You know, because you've absolved anyone else from feeling like they need to be innovative. Or worse, or maybe there were people that were innovative in the organization that are not in the office, but they feel like, well, you didn't include me, so I'm not going to help you out. And I actually had this conversation once. I won't say the name of the department. Let's just say it was a very big department in government that has a huge amount of budget. And they were trying to figure out how to modernize themselves. And this is why I was actually already working in government. They called me in June of 2015 and they said, you seem to have a reputation for dealing with difficult or any problems. Would you be willing to help us out? I said, well, I kind of have a full-time job already in government. They're like, would you be willing to work 6 months on weekends and nights for free? Because they can't pay me more because I'm already in government. And I said, well, it's a noble mission. I'm often one of those people that picks a mission, but I said, could I form a team of 12? And he said, well, if you can find 12 other people that are willing to work for free, yes. And I came back to them in about 2 weeks and I had this thing, this group called the XCell, which was, we were all in some capacity working for free to think about how to modernize this large department. And we came back with this idea, you can either do the top-down approach, but you know political leadership's going to change. And so they're just going to wait you out. And then this problem is going to still be there 2 years from now and 4 years from now, 6 years from now. You could create a single office, but that absolves anyone of that responsibility. Or this particular department, there was some friendly rivalries between the different, let's say, services. And that's actually a good thing, because what you can do is almost operate like an internal venture capitalist on the inside and say, here's what we're trying to do. Anyone who can make progress to it, you can get a spotlight from the secretary. You can get maybe some additional funding to accelerate your mission. You can get some outside experts that will bring to bear. But what we're going to do is we're going to celebrate what you're doing on the inside to move things forward. And we're always going to be scanning. And then you hold it up. And of course, the other services will start to get envious. And they'll go back to their folks and say, well, they're getting recognized. How come we aren't? And now you make it a friendly sort of competition to transform the organization. I call it the melted iceberg approach. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's necessary at scale. But I raise that because, yeah, you ask, whenever anyone creates a single office, or they try to drive it solely from the top down, or they separate the quote-unquote cool new kids from the existing kids, I am like, oh, this is going to end badly.
This speaks a lot to this concept, which you hear about in the private sector, about core and edge. And I'm curious, if you were to look at the ideas around core and edge, there's a couple ideas floating around. You've got, on one hand, our dear friend John Hagel, who says you need to separate them. The edge is this totally individual thing, and eventually it will grow and becomes the new core, and it will eat the core. You've got, on the other hand, people we had on this podcast also who talk about it's more like a Venn diagram with a permeable layer, a membrane between the two sides, to all the way to people saying this is all BS and you actually need to do core and edge in the same organization. It needs to be infused everywhere. Where do you land? What have you seen works from your perspective? What is the mental model you apply to that?
My mental model got shaped early on when I joined the Biotourism Program in 2000. We were only 30 people out of a 15,000 person organization called the CDC. And we existed because as we were paying the former Soviet republics to disarm, we discovered, oh, they actually had these things called plague labs, stockpiling smallpox. But even then, 2000, every 6 months, different parts of Congress would say, you're a Cold War relic, you don't need to exist. They'd cut our funding. And we were only 30 people, so there was not that much fun to cut. And it was scheduled weeks in advance for me to give a briefing on what we would do technology-wise should a bioterrorism event happen. That briefing was scheduled for September 11th, 2001, 9 o'clock in the morning, which of course, unfortunately, tragedy hit. We piled computers into cars at 8. We dealt with the response to 9/11. Did not sleep for 3 weeks because we wanted to make sure there wasn't a second biological event. So down from high alert on October 1st, October 3rd is when I flew up with a colleague and we briefed the CIA. And then the first case of anthrax showed up 24 hours later in Florida. Yeah. And even then, the first case of anthrax, there was no threat letter. It was just one sick person. So we were trying to figure out where it was coming from, but we actually did send up the hierarchy chain. Again, 30 people in a 15,000 person organization. If you discover that this is coming from the postal system, you're going to have to start doing prophylaxis of the postal workers. And then, of course, then the Capitol got hit and everything else. I raise that, though, because what I saw happen in those events was top leadership, not just at where I was at with the CDC, but also top leadership with the FBI and other government agencies. In some respects, this was a troubling, turbulent environment they'd never experienced before. They hadn't practiced before, and they called in their close friends. And while that, in some respects, that again, that makes you feel good because you've got your colleagues, you have, for example, a government agency that is not in public health going on camera saying the anthrax virus. And it's like, oh no, it's a bacteria. Let us do the public health bit. And then at the same time, you've got other parts of the CDC, because we had the surge to help out. Like 30 people were not going to deal with this by themselves. Now we had the surge, but they had not practiced with the FBI, and they were forgetting that it's also chain of custody of evidence, because this is actually a criminal investigation too. And so in some respects, that human nature of when crisis happens to pull in your friends made for a suboptimal response. And that motivated me after I was responding to West Nile. I later responded to monkeypox, severe acute respiratory syndrome in 2002, 2003. And I saw lessons incurred that were not lessons learned. And it was that hierarchy is not your friend when stuff hits the fan, when turbulent environments occur. But at the same time, when you're an organization of 15,000 people, you can't say we're all going to be flat. I mean, that's just ridiculous. And I know organizations both in the private sector and in the public sector that claim they're all flat. I'm like, you're not really. So I went to actually to a business school and came out with demonstrated evidence that what you really want to do, and this is what my PhD was in, is you want to empower bottoms-up hierarchy. So it's really the idea of the edge is there as the sensing network for what's happening. And then it's percolating. It's the job of a manager is not to force your view down. It's actually to reward those that are bringing the best insights up the chain to their boss, who should do the same. It's a learning organization. And I can't claim concrete credit for this. There's a James March. There's Herbert Simon. Herbert Simon, actually, he did his PhD back in the 1940s. It was actually on decision-making in government organizations. He later became one of the founders of the field of AI, which is kind of interesting that you go from seeing how governments make decisions to doing AI. And really what we need to think about in this new world is whether I look at it as it's the edge is the sensing part, whether it's a human node or a technology node, because increasingly we're going to have technology nodes that will be detecting things too, that then should give tips and cues to people further up in the hierarchy. And it's really not that a hierarchy gives you superiority. You are serving as a filter for what's the relevant information to go to other parts of the organization. So it's almost like how your body, you have your nerves. They tell you that you've touched something hot, but you don't want to get rid of the brain either, because the brain then says, okay, muscles, now we need to do something. But it's about making sure that you have as rapid a pathway from the edge to the other parts of the organization and vice versa, so you can live and adapt to that changing world.
Presumably that requires a very different approach to management. One which is probably very uncomfortable for many, right?
I have discovered nonprofits don't particularly like it. How about that? They're like, wait. I'm like, what are you doing empowering people? I'm like, because that's what you need to do. And so some people thrive on it. It's interesting. You have to be very careful with the people you select. I think a lot of people will say, yes, I want to be empowered. But the moment they're actually in an empowered position, that's when you discover whether, and again, it's not that they're off on their own. I mean, I'm here for when they call or anything like that to help them out. Our school systems, whether it be college, graduate, or whatever, we're teaching people, one, that you need to do what you're told, which is troublesome. And then two, if you're a manager, a good manager is telling them what to do. And I'm like, no, it's the exact opposite. You need to be entrepreneurial. You need to be scanning. You need to be passing insights up. And then if you're a manager, or if you're, I call a manager or a cultivator, you need to be rewarding and identifying those that bring the best insights and saying, can I help you out with this? Can I get you additional resources? Because you sent something over here. You need something more over here. And the interesting thing is, I think to a degree, venture capitalists, I keep on saying it's about internal venture capitalists in an organizational context. And the idea that the organization has a certain set of funds to keep the trains running on time, to make sure it does the things it has to do. But the other parts of funds and the other parts of the organization should always be exploring. And it's not a designated explorer part. It really is the entire organization, because oftentimes you'll find the things you need to change to in the parts that are making the trains run on time, where they're like, something's wrong here. This track is broken or whatever. If we improve it, we'll get an additional 15% margin if we can do that.
Presumably that also requires you to have different ways to flow information through the organization. And I know that's a huge can of worms we can open now in terms of how you do this.
One of the things I often do is I do this thing called boardwalks, which is you cap them at 30 minutes. No matter how large the organization, you cap them at 30 minutes. You do them at most twice a week. Usually I do a Monday and Thursday, but you can pick it. 30 minutes where everybody in the organization is assembled, and you do no more than the top 10 most important things going on in the team. And it's not you presenting. it's actually the project holders. And the first time you do it, they never get through all 10 because, you know, they go too long. They don't, they talk too much, and that's okay. But what you're doing is you want to see if the team can demonstrate ownership of whatever the top 10 things are. And you want to have it as an electronic board as well, because we now have remote teams. We had remote teams even before COVID-19, but increasingly. So anyone can add a question that they want asked about the project, or anyone can ask and raise a concern. But, you know, it's the idea of, can you simplify, even if you're a 20,000 person organization, can you simplify what are the top 10 things that everyone should be thinking about and democratize it so that anyone can raise a question or a concern? And then finally demonstrate that it's not you, the CEO, or you, the boss, or whatever, talking about all 10. It really is the individual owner of each of those topics being available both to give updates and receive questions from the organization as a whole.
How do you identify the top 10 in the first place?
Well, that's when you do the detective work. Going back to what I said earlier about its epidemiology, you're listening to the theory of the case, and then you almost are saying, I'm proposing doing these top 10. What do you think? And if someone comes back with a better argument, but you're doing the detective work to figure out what that is.
That is super interesting. David, we can go into this. Like, I would love to go into this way, way, way deeper.
We should do more. I would love to.
I would love to bring you back and talk just about this particular aspect of leadership. It's very dear and close to our heart in our work, where we talk about chaotic systems and decentralized innovation and these upside down ways of looking at the world. And we've seen them work. Clearly, I've seen them work very successfully. David, this was an absolutely phenomenal conversation. I adored your very different perspective. I really loved getting a perspective from more from the public sector. Into the civil sector, into our conversation. But there's so many rich learnings, I believe, we can take from what you just described and talked about and your experience you shared, and can take them even into the smallest of the private sectors, even if you're like running a startup and such. So David, thank you so much. There's so much richness in here. Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you, Pascal, as always. Look forward to more conversations, because it's only going to get more turbulent in the future ahead.
That is for sure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, it's Pascal. Thanks for tuning in on this episode of Disrupt Disruption. If you want more, check out the other episodes we have on this podcast. And if you liked it, do us a favor. Go on your podcasting platform of choice, iTunes, Google Play, whatever it is, and leave a quick review. It helps tremendously with getting the insights from our guests out into the world. If you have any questions, send me an email. You can reach me at pascal@finet.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I will hear you here soon.